history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that really ought to be told, and we're never going to hear them unless we take the time to ask a few questions and listen to what comes back our way. I think you're in for a treat today as we seek to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today I'm in Las Vegas, Nevada with 94-year-old Gloria Saucier. And I say 94, but I just don't believe it. You don't seem like you act 94. Gloria, what's your secret?
Eat your vegetables. I don't know.
Here, I thought you were the cookie lady.
Yes. Well, that helps. And have a lot of friends. If you can help them out, help them. I do a lot for veterans, and I think they've done so much for us, really. I was never overseas, so I don't think I should really consider myself as a veteran. But the ones that were overseas and had active duty, I think those are the ones that we should really be concerned about and, you know, do what we can do.
Well, I'm sure our listeners will form their own opinion after we hear your whole story. So let's start out with your childhood growing up in New Jersey. What was that like living through the Great Depression, which people today, some don't even know what it was?
It was actually my brother and I never enjoyed living during Depression, never enjoyed it so much. In order to save our home, we had to rent it out and move down to what you would call today a ghetto. And living in the ghetto, we learned to eat off, by imitation, of course, but to eat off tables of people that were Italian, Irish, Jewish, German. We all shared food. If we had food, we would share it one another. I had good times. I could tell you lots of stories about Depression. One quick little story is that we had to line up to get food, and you have to remember that this was in New Jersey, and we lined up, and I got a case of peaches, and on the outside of the box, I still remember this, was stencil, Folsom Prison, California. So here are the peaches were sent from the prison in California to New Jersey. That was sort of funny.
What kind of perspective did that give you? Because I imagine that there are probably some things you learned during those years that have stuck with you all the rest of these years.
Yes, it taught me to be able to consider other people in need, to share, to give whatever you can afford to give, and to learn to live with people of different nationalities, because basically we all have the same interests. We're interested in our families, our health, and we have so much in common. It actually, sometimes I would feel like it was one big nationality.
And you mentioned your brother. Now, I understand your brother was in the Navy before Pearl Harbor?
Yes, my brother was. And it was interesting because my mother was a Red Cross nurse during World War II, and my brother was in the Navy, and I was in the Marine Corps, and my father was an air raid warden. So we were the famous family of Elizabeth, New Jersey, and they had this huge, huge picture in the window of one of the department stores because we were a veterans family. Mm-hmm. But
you were the poster family. I mean, they had all four of you were doing something, so they wanted to make you an example?
Yes, yes. And it was quite an honor.
But before you became a Marine, December 7th, 1941 happened. And I bet you remember something about that day.
Yes. My brother was close to Pearl Harbor. Fortunately, he was on a destroyer escort, and they were able to get out of the harbor in time. So I was concerned about his health.
You probably heard about it on the radio or something?
Yes, we did. And I think the first reaction, I think a lot of us got, we thought that the Japanese would come right over and conquer all of us. It was kind of scary. And then there were rumors of submarines coming into the Hudson River. They would be the German submarines.
Yeah.
But after a while, things calmed down a little bit.
Well, and the German submarines had been operating off the Atlantic coast, and I'm sure that was stuff you heard about even before Pearl Harbor, right?
Yes.
How real or palpable was that fear or concern that the Germans might attack right there where you lived?
Scared us to death.
Keep you up at night, that kind of thing?
No, but the neighbors would discuss it a lot, and we were quite worried. Yes, we were.
And did I catch correctly that even had a hand in where you had to go to take flight lessons?
Exactly. There was a 90-mile limitation of flying in New Jersey because of our proximity to the Hudson River. So in order, the closest place where we could learn to fly would be in Pennsylvania. And that would be along the Delaware River and a little town called Martin's Creek. That's where we learned to fly.
And what gave you this idea that you ought to be a pilot?
When I was about 12 or 13, I'm not sure, I lived in New Jersey. And I remember the planes coming into Newark for a landing. And for some reason, our home was on their last leg. And I remember the planes flying over, and I would sit on the rooftop, and I could see the lights being turned on. These were night flights. And the lights being turned on in the cabin of the plane. And little did I realize that one day I would possibly be turning those lights on. But I've always wanted to fly. I don't know why, but I just... And even now, even today, when I see a plane fly over, I have to look. I really do.
I know the feeling. So you're a teenager, and you want to fly, but I'm sure there's a lot of kids that have that idea. So how did you make that happen? What kind of hoops did you have to jump through to get that opportunity?
Well, I was very fortunate because the Civil Air Patrol was taking in very young people. When I say very young, maybe 14 to 16, and they would take them on their missions. And the Civil Air Patrol also taught ground school, and there was no charge for ground school. So I took the ground school in New Jersey, and that's when I started taking flying lessons.
So what did it feel like the first time you got up in the air and you had the controls?
Oh, it was funny, because the way they usually do it, the instructor, you have maybe 7-8 hours of time with your instructors, and you learn all the, you know, the different stalls and things, and they get you prepared for the solo. But anyway, I was in a tandem side-by-side plane. It was a Taylorcraft. My instructor came up one day and he said, "I just canceled my life insurance, so I'm not flying with you anymore. You're going to have to fly on your own." So I said, "Oh, okay." So I was doing takeoffs and landings, you know, all morning, so there was nothing to it. So I took off, made my first turn, and I turned over to talk to the instructor. He wasn't there. I did get scared. So I did 3 takeoffs and landings. And on my second one, I came in a little too high. So I had to slip it in and correct it. I felt badly about that. I found out later that my instructor was very happy about that because he thought if something happened, I knew how to handle it. But it was a big thrill. It really was. And I did some aerobatics. I flew with another pilot, and we did aerobatics in a biplane. And that was a lot of fun. And as you know, if you do the perfect 360 turn in a biplane, you can feel your own prop wash. So when you do, then you know that you did it right.
Well, and how old were you that first solo flight?
I was about 16. And the funny part about it, I was too young to drive a car. But I guess when you're young, you're fearless, and you don't think of these things. But it's a wonderful feeling to be flying up there and checking things out and being prepared if you have to make a forced landing and the things that they would tell you. Like, of course, you always have to fly into the wind, and you would have to look at a lake and see which way the ripples are going or the birds that are flying, you know, just to figure out which way the wind is blowing.
Well, and here we were just talking a minute ago about the Depression and eating food from other people in the neighborhood and eating pizza sent from California, of all places. So I think the question comes up, how'd you pay for flight lessons? That couldn't have been easy.
No, it wasn't at all, because my parents didn't have the money. My brother, who was in the Navy, God bless him, would send me money. It cost $10 an hour, and they consider that wet, which means that's for the fuel. And it was through him that I was able to fly. He certainly did away with a lot of things by sending me all that money, that I realize. But I do remember him telling me, though, that he could buy a pack of cigarettes for 3 cents once he was out on the ocean.
Well, and so if you're flying at 16, did you have aspirations of maybe becoming a WASP and getting part of that program?
Absolutely. I wanted to get in the ferry command because I heard these gals were flying P-51s and P-38s, the Lightnings, you know. And, oh, what a thrill that would be. But unfortunately, the program was closed down before I could even apply. But I knew a lot of the gals. I flew with a lot of the gals that went ahead and became ferry pilots. I knew one gal, Pat Kensworthy. She was really tiny. She was like 5'2", 5'3". And it was hard for me to believe that she could fly a B-17 from Texas to England. They did remarkable things. They really did. I think they paved the way for women in aviation.
Without question. And there are other women doing other things in the war that paved the way for the future, too. And I'm sure you've run in a time or two to somebody who, when they find out that you served in the U.S. Marine Corps in World War II, they say, wait a second, there weren't any women in the Marine Corps in World War II? But there were. How did you find out about that program and become one of the really few, the really proud female Marines of World War II?
Well, I wanted to get close to aviation, and when the program had closed down, the WASP program closed down, I was trying to get something, and I felt I owed, well, I felt, shall I say, patriotic, or I had a responsibility, because we were at war, and when this Marine recruiter told me that I would be very acceptable, I just went ahead and joined up. I never, never regretted it. Boot camp was interesting. We had DIs, drill instructors. They were all men, and most of them were from Guadalcanal, active duty, and they hated the women. And they would tell us, we're going to march you to the river. And I tell you, we got our feet wet. We really did. We would never, ever not do. Or at midnight, this was in Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, where I took my boot camp training. And at midnight, we were out there among the pine trees picking up cigarette butts. And I was scared to death because I'm afraid of snakes. And I heard that there's a lot of snakes out there. But I'm so indebted to the Marine Corps. It allowed me to go to language school to learn French and Spanish. It allowed me to go to the University of New Mexico with the GI Bill, with something that was offered to us. And I learned how to follow orders. I learned history of the Marine Corps, which gave me a lot of pride. And even today, I feel very, very proud to be a Marine. I met many, many women in the Marine Corps, and I've kept up with a couple of them up until a few years ago. So anyway, I'm really beholden, and I'm glad I joined up.
Now, and I've met a few women Marines of World War II, and I've met a lot of male Marines of World War II, and you hear that once a Marine, always a Marine. And some guys have even told me that it just completely rewires their brain, that their whole mentality or view of themselves changes when they become a Marine. Was it that transformative for you?
Yes, it was. And I think part of it in the boot camp training, when you learn the history of the Marine Corps, you take on a different aspect, and you just can't help but feel very proud. Even today, if someone mentions, oh, were you in the service? I have to mention that I was in the Marine Corps, because I am proud. And whenever I see a fellow Marine or Marine wearing a cap, I always say Semper Fi, because that is a little signal that we have among ourselves. But yes, I was very lucky, and I'm grateful and thankful that I was able to be in the Marine Corps.
And we'll explore some of her World War II duties in the Marine Corps when we come back, plus how Gloria's love of aviation propelled her to a post-war career in the air, and how a recent honor flight brought her back to a familiar face from her past. Find photos of Gloria then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a chance today to meet one of the few, the proud, the women Marines of World War II. 94-year-old Gloria Saucier of Las Vegas, Nevada, originally from Roselle Park, New Jersey. She learned to fly by age 16. But with the WASP program shutting down, she became one of more than 22,000 American women who answered the recruiter's call to be a Marine, free a man to fight. She joined the Marine Corps Women's Reserve in 1944 and soon was off to boot training at Camp Lejeune in North Carolina. You mentioned you had drill instructors who had fought on Guadalcanal. Male Marines are fighting all over the Pacific at this point, but the whole purpose of the Women Marine program was to take a job for a man so he could go and fight, right? Did that seem like a noble purpose for you, or was there part of you that said, hey, maybe we should go overseas too?
Well, at that time, since I knew that women Marines didn't go overseas, the WACs, the Army gals, they did go overseas. Some of them did. But I remember 2 years ago, I made a memorial speech, and it was on Veterans Day. The thing that I said in the speech, and I truly feel this, is that there was a young man in my graduating class in high school, and he was the first man that was killed. He was killed at Guadalcanal, and his name was Jackie Rydell, and his father owned a hardware store. And Jackie was very handsome, great football hero. Everybody loved him. And I often thought he gave his life, and had he been spared, would he have married the hometown girl? Would he have become a very famous football player? These are things that I think of. So the reason why I'm giving this speech, it's to honor all the Jacks and Jackies that are our service people now. So I feel that this should be a Jackie Rydell Day. He was a great guy. He really was. I'm digressing, and I don't want to do that. No.
I think that's one of the most powerful things we can talk about, because the reality is 406,000 Americans died in World War II. They never got to live the kind of life that you've had for the last 70-plus years. And when you tell those stories, it puts it in perspective. And as for you, was there something within the Marine Corps at that time that you were hoping to do, a duty or assignment that maybe you thought you might draw?
No, I was very happy being transferred to El Toro.
Well, you've got to tell us the story of how that happened, because that wasn't your first assignment after you got out of boot camp.
No, my first assignment was in Washington, D.C. in Officers Performance. And Officers Performance is where we would have to type the activities. This was of the pilots, of the fighter pilots in the Pacific. and you had a monthly report. And on each page, they would give the name of the pilot, his religious affiliation, his background, his education, college education, etc. So, you know, naturally being very young and typing up these documents, you got to know some of these pilots, and you felt you got to know them pretty well. And then I remember then you would finally get one where one would have been shot down and they closed the files on that particular person. So I did enjoy working in Washington, but it was one young gal, she was an officer in the Marine Corps. She was married to a Marine, but she became pregnant, so she had to leave the Marine Corps. She didn't want to, but she had to leave. And she said, the last thing I'm going to do, she says, I'm going to get Gloria West out of line company and put her at El Toro in the tower, closer to aviation. So I'm really beholden to her, because that was a very nice gesture. And I think that's how I got it, or otherwise I probably wouldn't have. I don't have any special skills. I mean, you know, I could fly a plane a little bit, but I've always had a love of flying. I think it's something that gets in your blood. I don't know. I just, sometimes I go overboard.
So you're there in Washington, D.C., typing up all these reports about the flying leathernecks overseas, and they find out about your history and interest in aviation, this friend of yours, so she recommends you to be transferred out to the West Coast. So what were your duties out there in Southern California at El Toro?
Well, in those days, we didn't have, as far as control towers, you had to realize that we had flash guns, and flash guns are light guns, and they're like red and yellow, like traffic lights. So what we did, there were a lot of practice carrier landings. Most of the planes were either Corsairs, F4Us, or Hellcats, and that's what we did. It was pretty exciting times, you know, and El Toro was I really enjoyed El Toro. It was a wonderful station.
So what did you have to do there? What, give us a sense of a daily performance that you had to carry out.
I just would report to the tower in the morning. We'd have to check, you know, the flight schedules, what's going on.
So you were air traffic controller, basically?
Well, basically, but not what you would consider today's state. We didn't have the sophisticated equipment. Like I said, we used ray guns, radio. I worked with a couple other gals. There were about five of us in the tower. But I always enjoyed the when they practiced the carrier landings, because there'd be maybe four or five planes taking off and landing at the same time. Mm-hmm. And a lot of precision flying. And I thought that was always interesting, at least interesting to me.
And you got to tell them all what to do, or who was first? And
No, we would give them the green light to take off. Yeah, we give them clearances, right? Visual clearances, yes. And most of this was all VFR. We weren't involved. I was not involved in any night flights or any instrument flights as well.
Did you feel a responsibility? Was there a weight to any of that, of these guys are in the air, and a lot of times the guys who are flying at El Toro are guys who are just learning, right? They're in training. They're learning how to be these fighter pilots. That there was a responsibility on your part to keep them safe, to bring them back in, to not set up some disaster in the air?
Most of the pilots were seasoned. They had a lot of experience. So I think they probably would end up telling us what to do instead of us telling them what to do. But they had a lot of, I felt there was more respect for women in the Marine Corps affiliated with aviation.
You mean as opposed to away from aviation?
As opposed to line company, which is the opposite. Yes. Mm-hmm.
So the pilots treated you ladies pretty well?
Yes.
You had to be grossly outnumbered, right?
Well, yes.
Which can be a good thing, I guess.
Which can be a very good thing, yes. But, geez, you're bringing back memories.
Are there some stories that come to mind of certain pilots who were there, or things that you became aware of, or things that stand out?
I do remember we had two majors, and they were both Irishmen. They were pilots, but they worked in the control tower as well. They were always arguing, but in a nice way, but they couldn't start the day off without an argument. They were both from the same county in Ireland. That may have something to do with it. I know one was O'Brien, and the other one was Kelly. They were amusing. They were a lot of fun, but they were good pilots as well. That's about all. I wasn't there very long. I was in the Marine Corps from 44 to 46, just during the duration of the war.
Well, and about that, how often would you hear what was happening in the war? I'm sure you still have your brother to worry about, and now you're part of the Marine Corps, and I'm sure you had an interest in what was happening overseas. How did you stay up with the bigger picture?
One thing that became very realistic to me was when I was in boot camp at night, we had these bunk beds, I remember, and I always slept on the top. And when they would wake us up in the morning, they would throw the switch and the lights would flood the barracks. And I remember the first night I was there, I fell off the top bunk bed because of the light flash. But on another serious note, it was one morning again in the barracks during boot camp. I was around 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. I heard this loud scream. The lights came on, and I saw this one girl. She was just crying her heart out and screaming. Well, what had happened? Her husband was a Marine, and she just got notified. Why they notified her 2 or 3 in the morning, I don't know, that he had been killed. And I think you have little bits of realism like that. It brings it home. And then you realize what you're doing and what you're fighting for. And I hope I did some good. I mean, we all like to think we were important. But like I say, the Marine Corps really rewarded me with all the gifts of education and other things that they gave me, and discipline. And I even think today, as old as I am, I still carry my shoulders back. And I think that has something to do with boot camp. I really do.
I'm sure there's no doubt that's the case. So what about the end of the war? Were you still at El Toro when that developed?
No, I was transferred to Miramar, which is another Marine Corps air station.
Which is still in operation, and in fact is where the only Marine Corps Aviation Museum, the Flying Leathernecks Air Museum, is. Have you been there?
No, I haven't.
You ought to go. They'd love to have you.
Pappy Boyington?
They have a lot about Pappy Boyington, about Joe Foss.
Joe Foss, I have to tell you. Joe Foss, the biggest thrill of my life. I got to fly with Joe Foss.
What?
Yes.
How come you didn't tell me this before?
Well, you made me think of Joe Foss. Joe Foss, after he did active duty, he was assigned to fly the mail run. And he would fly the mail run from El Toro to Santa Barbara, to Goleta, which is right outside of Santa Barbara, the Marine Corps Air Station there. And so they asked, I was in the tower, and they said, well, who wants to fly with Joe? And, of course, I raised my hand, and... So I got to fly with him. Great guy, wonderful guy. I think he was a major at the time. But I do remember he smoked these big cigars, these big black cigars, terrible. But he was so nice, and he let me handle the plane a little bit while we were flying, no big deal. But I remember it was a Beechcraft, and it was a high wing, I think a high wing Beechcraft. But we flew the mail run. And I did it one other time with him. I did it twice. He went on to become governor of, was it South Dakota? Mm-hmm. Yeah. But he was quite a hero. I mean, he was very quiet, very serious, good pilot, of course.
Most decorated pilot there was at the time.
Oh, really?
Medal of Honor winner, yeah.
I did not know that, yeah.
How did he treat you?
Oh, he was very nice, very polite. And with a lot of respect. And I was admiring him the whole time, and I was thrilled to pieces that I thought something I could tell my grandchildren. Yeah. And I just forgot about it.
Well, you got to go down there to San Diego now at that Flying Leathernecks Museum. They have a whole display that's nothing but Joe Foss and stories about him. Yeah. So Miramar is where you were when the war came to an end?
I was discharged from Miramar.
Well, we've heard stories about the end of the war in Times Square or San Francisco and certainly ships at sea. I've heard some of those stories. But if you go to San Diego now, they've got a giant, larger-than-life statue of that kiss in Times Square with the sailor and the nurse.
Really?
They do. But I'm wondering, what was that celebration like at the time in San Diego when news of VJ Day came? Were people out in the streets celebrating? Did you guys do anything special?
I think I had a beer. I don't remember. We did a lot of celebrating. I don't specifically remember VJ or VE. I remember being discharged and going home. It was great to get back home again. And then I was preparing. I still wanted to be involved with flying. So I wanted to be an airline hostess. And TWA was my choice because they flew overseas and eventually I would like to have gone overseas. But I flew in for 5 years, loved every minute of it, and started out with DC-3s onto Constellations. I never flew on jets. The jets came later. I think the jets came around, 56, somewhere around there.
Well, I imagine that had to be a little bit different from being a flight attendant today.
I know. I belong to an organization of retired flight attendants, and I still have one friend who's still flying. It's so different. It's so different because the security that you have to go through and the disrespect that passengers will give you, it just wasn't the same. It was, it was the best of times, to quote Charles Dickens, but the passengers were very polite, well-dressed, very respectful of us. We felt the same way towards the passengers. But now, with the security and everything that you have to go through, it's not fun anymore. When passengers would get on planes, they would walk on the tarmac and just board that way. I remember one time in Chicago, there was a very, very bad snowstorm and a DC-3, and you have to be careful because of the icing on the wings. So what they did, they got this little cart, a mule, I think they call them. They dragged the plane into the hangar. We boarded passengers in the hangar. The little mule took us out to the runway, and then we took off. This prevented us from getting a lot of extra ice on the leading edge of the wings, but it was different. It was so entirely different.
Well, and I can hear the sentimentality there and the fact that you miss some of the things about it, but is there anything that you think back on about how you guys did it in the 1950s in commercial aviation as a flight attendant that you say, I can't believe we did that?
Well, we had to wear high heels and we'd have a food service and we would serve. I can't believe that I did this. One time I was bending down, holding a tray, and we hit, they call them air pockets, they aren't, but we hit an updraft, and I flew up and came right down and was just as I started out, the tray in hand. And
so your whole body in a squatting position, right, holding a tray, flies up off the floor of the airplane, and you come back down, and you didn't lose anything?
No. Yeah, we had good times.
It's time for another break. Gloria Saucier of Las Vegas, Nevada is our guest today. There's another pretty colorful anecdote about her TWA flight attendant days to come. And I think you're really going to be floored by what this World War II Marine discovered during her honor flight to Washington, D.C. We'll hear how that journey to our nation's capital proved to be a journey back in time to rediscover a connection to her past. You'll find a short video about that part of Gloria's story at hometownheroesradio.com. Or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and today's conversation with 94-year-old Gloria Saucier of Las Vegas, Nevada. A native of New Jersey, Gloria served in the Marine Corps Women's Reserve during World War II. She's proud of the way her whole family supported the war effort, from her brother on a destroyer escort in the Navy, to her mother as a Red Cross nurse, her father as an air raid warden. In a moment, we're going to hear the amazing connection Gloria made as the result of her trip to Washington, D.C. with Honor Flight Southern Nevada. But first, a very unique situation she encountered during the 5 years she spent as a TWA flight attendant after World War II.
The most interesting thing that ever happened on my flight, I was flying with another gal. Her name was Gloria Henshaw. So there are two Glorias on this flight. But this was a constellation. And we would fly from San Francisco, Phoenix, Albuquerque, and Chicago. Those were the stops. Well, the flight attendants had hostess seats in the rear of the plane, of the Lockheed Constellation. But this, as we departed from San Francisco, this little man came up and said to us, "Do you mind if I sit right in front of your seats?" And we said, "No, no, that's fine." So as we were flying, we were about ready to land in Phoenix. He said, "Would you do me a favor?" He said, "Would you look out and see if there's anybody there on the runway?" Because the main cabin door was adjacent to where our seats were. Mm-hmm. So we looked out and we said, "No, there's nobody there standing on the tarmac." Then we got to Albuquerque, and he asked the same thing, same question. And so we said, "Oh, sure, we'll do it." Well, there was no one there. Then finally, when we landed at Chicago, we looked out, and there were about four or five men, real tall men. I remember that, and they were dressed in suits. He says, "Anybody out there?" And I said, "Oh, yes." And so he looked out. He says, "Oh, that's wonderful." So he got off the plane, but he found out that Gloria and I were staying at the Del Prado Hotel in Chicago. So as a result, we were lookouts for this gangster, and his name was Al Green. And we had a layover in Chicago overnight. In those days, you'd have longer layovers. And he sent down a limousine. He had a couple men in the limousine, and they had flowers for us, and they took us to the Ambassador Hotel. First time I ever had lobster in my life. And then we went to the Chez Parisien nightclub, and we realized that one of the so-called gangsters or bodyguards, whatever, was dating one of the little chorus girls, and we got to meet the group of entertainers. And it was just wonderful. So when I told my mother later about the story, how we wined and dined and had such a wonderful time, my mother almost died. She says, "Do you realize that you were with gangsters? But, you know, I think we're probably more protected than anybody else," because he had this, you know, entourage. I'd say about at least six men there. So we were lookouts. Gloria and I were lookouts. Those were good days. They were fun days.
Well, and I don't want to miss anything in all those decades in between that's important to you, so feel free to share it. But there's a twist to your story just in the last couple of years here that actually opened up a chapter of your past that has been pretty exciting. It started with Honor Flight Southern Nevada and going with other veterans to Washington, D.C. to see those memorials. What was that experience like for you on that trip?
That was the biggest thrill. Well, the biggest, meeting all these other veterans, and they were so nice and so interesting. There was only one other woman veteran on the flight. Unfortunately, she was in a wheelchair, and she had to be contained in a certain area. But we did get to room together. The thing about that flight was to visit all the memorials, and then to visit the woman's memorial, which is fairly new, and learn that a very good friend of mine that I learned to fly with became quite famous. And she had a book in the Women's Memorial. And the people who were taking care of me went and purchased the book. And I didn't realize until after I read the book that we had the same flight instructors. We knew each other quite well. She went on and became very famous. She got to fly with Jacqueline Cochran. She and Hap Arnold and Barry Goldwater got to reinstate these women ferry pilots as veterans.
So the WASPs of World War II, whose program had been disbanded during the war, but who risked their lives in ferrying all these flights to so many places, they weren't recognized with veteran status until she was part of that effort to get a veteran status.
Exactly, exactly. And I had the privilege of learning to fly with her.
So you learned to fly with her in the 40s, but you hadn't talked to her or maybe even thought about her since then, right?
Never wondered what happened to her. I had no knowledge of her importance and what she did. And she continued her career in aviation. And she's a wonderful role model, I think, her whole life, what she's done for women in aviation. I would put her along with Jacqueline Cochran, possibly Amelia Earhart. You know, these were the gals that paved the way.
And her name is Bee Falk, her married name, Haydu. And so you learn about her. You see this book, thanks to the guardians on your honor flight who gave it to you. You're reading through it. You see all these things, and the alarm bells go off. And I'm sure at some point you thought, well, hey, maybe she's still out there somewhere. Maybe I can talk to her. What'd you do about it?
Well, my niece was the one that found out that Bee is living in Florida. She is 97 years old. She'll be 98 in December. And she got her phone number, her address. And, of course, I called her. And I had to tell her it's Gloria West because that was my maiden name. And we just couldn't get over. We had so much to talk about. Our instructors, our flights, our terrible landings.
You didn't tell me about those.
Well, you bounce them in sometimes. But anyway, it was wonderful. And I can't say enough about the honor flight. I try to contribute to them because I think what they do is just it's so worthwhile. And these veterans, particularly the men that were overseas and saw active service, they're the ones I think that should be remembered. A lot of them are older and they don't feel well and they feel they're neglected. And then to give them an honor flight and make them feel so great, you know about the quilt.
Well, yeah, I do, but I'm sure there are plenty of our listeners who haven't heard of this before. In the state of Nevada, every single veteran who goes on an honor flight, whether it's out of Reno or like you with Honor Flight Southern Nevada out of Las Vegas, every one of those vets is presented with a quilt that is hand-sewn by the volunteers with the Quilts of Valor Foundation. You know, I'll go ahead and put up a link to Quilts of Valor at hometownheroesradio.com. Nationwide, nearly 200,000 of these quilts have been awarded to veterans since the effort first started in 2003. And when you went on the honor flight, Gloria, you received one of those quilts, which you proudly display here in your home.
Yes, it's lovely. And then the other thing, to be able to place a reef on the tune of the Unknown Soldier, and then to hear taps played right after, it was quite an emotional experience. And there was quite an audience around, and it was nice because it's something we felt as a group. Even though you didn't know these people, you just had this wonderful, wonderful patriotic feeling. It was, you know, it was really something. But as I told you earlier, what's impressed me more than anything else was people that did not know you and would do so much for you. And even the little Girl Scout troops, they would save their pennies so they could buy me a bouquet of roses or write placards. And you know, it's nice to know there's so many wonderful people out there. We don't hear about them. And I was fortunate and very, very lucky to be able to experience all these things. I feel so privileged. I don't know what I've done to earn it. I hope someday I'll be able to say I've done something. But it's a good feeling. And like I say, there's so many people out there that don't even know us that are willing to do things for us.
Well, and the reason those folks are willing to do things for you is they know what you did for the rest of us, that you were willing to put your life on hold and serve our country however you could. And I've talked to a lot of vets who've been on the honor flight, and they're always, you know, amazed by the places they see, the way they're treated. A lot of people say even, you know, when they come back, it's the homecoming they never got in World War II. And they make friends with the other veterans on the flight. But I've yet to meet someone who's got a story like yours where you reconnected with a friend from 75 years ago only because of the honor flight. How do you explain all that? How do you make sense of that?
No, I think the good Lord works in many mysterious ways. And I think I have a lot of little angels around me. I don't know. It's It's hard to believe, it really is, that this all has happened because of the honor flight. I do admire the people that are involved in the honor flight. They do so much work involved. You know, there's a lot of planning. I know the veterans were so pleased. And I remember when we landed, we had the fire department had that shield of water. And that was a big, big thrill. And the other big thrill that I really liked, when we stayed at Baltimore, so we had to drive from Baltimore. They took the bus from Baltimore into Washington, D.C. So as a result, this is just this little two-lane highway. We had a motorcycle policeman in front of the bus. We had a police car on the right side of the bus preventing oncoming traffic as we were just going through. The policeman on the motorcycle, I don't know how he did it, but he had his hands off the motorcycle, and he was telling the cars, you know, one in this lane, that lane. And when we got into Washington, we just went through all the red lights, we went through everything. I mean, and people were standing on the corners and looking at us and wondering, well, who are these people? But you know, it was fun, and it really made you feel, you know, important. But it was like one of the best Disneyland rides I've ever had in my life. I really enjoyed it.
You know, I was thinking maybe I should ask you, if one of your great-grandkids says, what was being a woman Marine all about? What do we need to know about World War II and what you did? But one of your granddaughters has actually made a documentary on you, so your family's aware of this.
My granddaughter, yeah, made a documentary about my life. Of course, I'm very proud of her. She graduated with honors, and she's a pretty sharp gal.
What is important for the rest of us to know about the trailblazing role that you had? Because you were one of the first female Marines, and now women have opportunities that you ladies couldn't dream of 75 years ago. What should we remember about that, and what would you say you're most proud of?
Well, I think I'm most proud of my mother. My mother was a type of person. She was a nurse, but she encouraged me in my flying. She encouraged me with the Marine Corps. My mom and dad they would always write to me. They would always tell me how proud they were. And my mother was a great encourager. And I think I'm very grateful for her. I probably wouldn't do half the things that I did if it weren't for her. And she had confidence in me. And she was way ahead of her times.
The documentary that your granddaughter did on you features you reciting a poem that a lot of aviation aficionados might recognize. Not to put you on the spot, but can you recite it on the spot? You still have it memorized?
I think I remember most of it. Of course, you realize this was an RAF pilot, McGee, I believe was his name. His mother had received a letter with the poem in it. And unfortunately, after she received the letter, she received notice that he had been killed. But it's called High Flight. I just think it's the most beautiful, beautiful poem. I can sort of follow every word he says because the way he feels about flying, you know. I have slipped the surly bounds of earth and danced the sky on silvered wings. Sunward I climbed and joined the tumbling mirth of sun-split clouds and done 100 million things you have not dreamed of. Wheeled and soared and spun my eager craft through footless halls of space. Up, up, the long, delirious, burning blue where never a lark or even eagle flew. And while in silent lifting mind I've trod the untrespassed something of space, put out my hand and touched the face of God. I don't remember the way I used it.
That sounded pretty good to me. I don't want to leave anything out that's important to you. And I also don't want to forget to thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us your pretty unique story here. I guess I have to ask you with regard to your friend B. So you've reconnected after all these decades. You've talked on the phone. Have you thought about maybe meeting up with her somewhere?
Yes. I have a friend who's a flight attendant now with United. And I told her the story, and she says, well, I fly into Miami. So she says, let's work on something. So we're going to see what we can do. I'd like to surprise her.
Well, please let us know when that happens, because what a precious postscript that would be to your unique story that you've shared with us today. That is Gloria Saucier. I told you she didn't sound 94. Pull up the photos and video at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Big thanks to Belinda Morse of Honor Flight Southern Nevada for again introducing me to a special vet she's had the chance to take to our nation's capital. And thank you for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we're reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.